House Committee on Revenue. It is Friday the 3rd of June, and today we're going to kind of try and stay on task. It's just a couple of minutes after 1 o'clock, but we've got both work sessions, public hearings, and then some work sessions, and wrapping up with Senate Joint Resolution 14 later this afternoon, and we'll have kind of go in that order. We will be pushing some of these bills through with action, and in some cases we will still be holding off. So with that, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 480. Paul, you want to give us an update there, please?
Mr. Chair, it is strictly an update. There are no new amendments for the committee. The chair is working with the Department of Revenue and other members of the committee to look at some of the elements of 480, in particular looking at the issue we have discussed about reportable and listed transactions, Department of Revenue authority beyond the IRS code. So we continue to review that and work with some of the interested parties. The other issue is looking at the measures in it, which included the website for delinquent taxpayers, and to see if there may be another alternative. The department has a bill that's looking at for lien register that may provide an alternative way of looking at that. So to coordinate with that other legislation, and those are the two main areas right now that we're looking at. Those areas would be unlikely to have any effect on the revenue impact.
Thank you, Paul. Colleagues, I've worked have formed a kind of an informal work group, which includes some folks from industry and from taxation, as well as the Legislative Revenue Officer and myself. And we still have a meeting with some of the attorneys that want to come to the table to. I don't think there's any major amendments that are going to occur as a result of that. As staff has indicated, we still are down to just a couple of amendments. I'm concerned about the fiscal costs of setting up in a public square the stocks to put 100 people into to show that they're the folks that haven't paid their taxes, particularly if there's other bills to try and publish on a website. Every one of those in the state of Oregon money. So with that, we'll continue to work on that, and my commitment to you as a committee is that we'll come back at least one more time and hopefully have some amendments to make sure that this is a good piece of legislation, that we can get the voluntary compliance out of the bill and still extract the necessary revenue without impinging upon the state's voluntary assessment system. So with that, we'll bring this back. I anticipate we'll meet either Wednesday or Thursday of next week. So kind of keep your schedules open. We will not be meeting Monday or Tuesday at this particular point. Yes, Representative Galizio.
Just for the record, if I can make a couple of observations. And it's funny, yesterday I was talking to a person who will remain nameless. And
I have a friend who.
Yeah, they live.
Miss Deborah?
Well, they have a small business, and they were talking about taxes and describing how another person they knew who had a business, very well off, he was expressing that he was concerned that this person wasn't sort of paying his fair share and kind of very angry. And it was sort of, it illustrated to me what I think some of the testimony talked about is the notion that those people who are sort of playing by the rules and are paying their taxes and do have a burden, to the extent they perceive that that is not the case for the rest of the people in the community and in the state, that is problematic for compliance overall. And I think Representative McPherson talked about the culture of compliance. And I know a lot of the focus is how much revenue can we get back, and I understand that's very significant. But I do think to the extent we can look at the system and structure it in a way that there is kind of a culture of compliance, perceived fairness and equity, I think that's a really critical part of it. And I hope that in the work group that's discussed. And also, secondly, on the, and I, you know, Mr. Chair, you're the expert on this, and a lot of this has been new information for me, but in terms of the reportable transactions, to the extent we're limiting the Department of Revenue's ability to identify abusive tax shelters. I think that's problematic. So I understand you don't want to create a culture that makes it seem that the state and the Department of Revenue is out to get people. And on the other hand, again, for the person who's paying their fair share, I hope that we're doing things to create a perception of equity.
And Representative Galizio, let me try and respond to the second point. And while we do want to have certainly a culture of compliance, the self-assessment system is really, if it's going to work in Oregon, we're going to have to cut it some slack and then make the stick big enough to beat those that don't comply under the voluntary system. But relative to your second point related to making certain that the department is able to identify those areas that are of concern, we want to open it up to make sure that that we can identify all of the listed areas and identified areas under the federal law, and as the federal law continues to open up new avenues, because these folks seem to have new ways of getting around the system. Each door you open, or each door you tap closed, they'll open up a window somewhere. So the idea there would be to make certain that they have enough latitude to work, number one, with the federal system, because if we see that the feds will typically identify it long before we will, and there's good coordination cooperation there, and we meet, of course, every 2 years to consider these kinds of things. So new items, new tax schemes can be thrown into the list of the types of endeavors that are involved on behalf of taxpayers who would try and cheat or trick the system. But I'm anxious, as are folks in industry, that Oregon be in the forefront of trying to figure out how we're going to, what new scheme we're going to identify. That's a very expensive process. There's a lot of litigation that goes with it, with that kind of stuff, and a lot of research. And quite honestly, the big arm of the feds, of the IRS, is typically the place where we get the best information. So I think we can all get there together and keep the system as operating as inexpensively as we possibly can as the Department of Revenue, because I mean we've done this before. We've put more money into the system with a guaranteed extraction amount. It's the bell curve that you start looking at and you say, are we really close to going over the marginal rate of return on that? That's been an area that I know that the director has been very anxious about as we try and push the envelope as much as we can. But your points are well taken. Further discussion relative to 480? Yes, Representative.
I'd like to kind of follow up on that, if I may. I heard during testimony schemes that the federal government doesn't care about because they don't affect the federal government. And I'm concerned that that is not addressed. And what I'm talking about is we heard about moving things from state to state and that doesn't affect the federal at all. And these are the kind of things that I'm concerned about if we don't allow anything other than what the federal guidelines provide.
Representative Riley, one of the things that we're trying to do, and certainly as we address the REITs and RICs, and that's real property. Those are real property oriented, and to the extent that people have been, or that businesses or entities have been able to identify, or identify an opportunity to shift income away from Oregon into a tax-free state through a REIT or a RIC on real property located within the state of Oregon, I think we're all anxious about that, and I'm comfortable that we're going to attempt to try and get a good hold on that. And I think that in part is part of the listing of these transactions to let people come back into the system. I think that's probably one of the larger areas that we'll anticipate collecting on under the voluntary compliance initiative. So I appreciate you bringing that up, because sometimes I don't I eventually, if the Internal Revenue Service can reach out and get a hold of something, they will. And typically that information is shared. Part of that is that we need to hold the director's feet to the fire in some respects to make certain that all of the database that is available to the state of Oregon on people who have any nexus to the state of Oregon, and that database is available, that the director is able to wring everything out of that and possibly can. And part of that is just a matter of finances, of how much resources you have to try and do that. And while I'm not anxious to again come back and direct the director to do more than she can do with the resources, we've had a very good in the Ways and Means process and with the governor, very good dialogue as to what kinds of things the director identifies early on, working with other states who are in the same position. Whether you're in Idaho, California, or Utah, those folks all have sales taxes, but they all depend largely on income taxes as well. So when they see these things move to Washington, Texas, Montana, or to other states with no income tax, Texas, Nevada, those kinds of things, then that's a tax gimmick, and again, the director works with the folks that have access to that database.
But Mr. Chair, if I might add to Representative Riley's point, the department now is very active in using a database that's supplied by California from their efforts. So California, of course, with a much larger capacity in terms of doing that kind of analysis, has been willing to share that information with other states. So that's been an important source of information for the DOR as well as other states.
And while that may not capture, because of the high rate of income tax in California, that may not capture those interstate transactions that we're looking for, it adds one more tool to the tool chest that is available to us. What we've got to make sure is we've got enough revenue or enough resource in the Department of Revenue to address the database.
Great.
Further comments or questions as we continue to work 480? With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 480, and we'll come back and visit that. Representative Boquist, are you ready on 3333? I know this. Okay. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3333. Lizbeth? Representative Krupp, you're going to tell us what you've been up to here, too. Ms. Beth, you want to give us an
Chairman
update?
Butler and committee members, with House Bill 3333A, we've already heard this bill. It was in conjunction with a couple other bills. But what this one is doing is one of the charitable checkoff bills. It's creating the Wounded Soldier Relief Program in the Oregon Military Department. And it then defines the purpose of the program to provide grants to members of the Oregon National Guard, members of the reserves who are Oregon residents and have been called on active duty and who have been wounded or injured on federal active duty. And then it allows the department to provide grants for these soldiers for their housing, medical expenses, clothing, utilities, or other necessities of daily life. Then it allows the military department the authority to establish procedures for applying for these grants and establishing eligibility to receive the grants. And then it allows the taxpayers the opportunity to make contributions through the charitable checkoff program to the Wounded Soldier Relief Program. And this is one where the language in this is permissive in the sense that it doesn't direct the Department of Revenue to put this particular fund on the face of the personal income tax statement. It just says that if space is available, the Department of Revenue will put the Wounded Soldier Relief Program on the face of the personal income tax return. And if there's not space, then it shall be given a listing in the instruction booklet. So as we heard from
with
testimony,
all the rest of those that are on
yeah,
the page.
Yes, and as we heard testimony from the Department of Revenue, that was one thing that they wanted was some flexibility and then not causing a fiscal or a large fiscal in order to expand the personal income tax return. Now, it is establishing the Wounded Soldier Relief Program charitable checkoff account in the state treasury. Then monies that are contributed to that account then shall be continuously appropriated to the Oregon Military Department. And then it deletes the requirement under current law to have those four different types of donations amounts printed on the tax return. So basically, it's just allowing the $10 or other. And then it provides the Department of Revenue with directions to maximize the number of eligible entries shown on the income tax form and rulemaking authority to establish a program of then rotating these eligible checkoffs charities on the face of the personal income tax return. And it deletes the requirement that a charity must receive $50,000 or more in contributions in order to remain on the face of the tax form, and then it allows a rotating of charities on the face of the personal income tax return. And then it applies beginning on or after the effective date of this 2005 Act. So there's no revenue impact again on this. And we've already discussed the differences and basically the amount of contributions that charities get, whether on the face or in the listing of the...
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. Representative Krupp, thank you for coming, and thank you for your work with Representative Boquist on this bill. I know that you worked it through the Veterans Committee, and had an excellent opportunity to work through this issue. Did you want to make further comments to Representative Krupp?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to just spend a few moments here. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. I'm pleased that you're going to move forward with the bill. Representative Nelson, who could not attend this hearing, had wanted to change one word in the bill, but I think in the interest of expediency that we could possibly do that on the Senate side. And the reason is that this is a companion bill with House Bill 3334, which you've already passed out of this committee, which will be on the House floor on Thursday, and that's why I would ask you to pass this bill today. I would like to have both of these bills passed across the House floor on the same day, as I am asking members of the 2nd Battalion that I visited in Baghdad, Iraq, to come here to the Capitol on that particular day when we pass these two pieces of legislation, which are, frankly, as a result of my visit with them in Iraq. So in the interest of timeliness, I would like to, if we're going to make any minor changes, they would be over on the Senate side, Mr. Chairman. And I thank you for the opportunity to bring this bill.
Thank you very much, Representative. Questions of either Representative Krupp or the staff? Representative Galizio?
This could be for either Representative Krupp. I just, and maybe this was mentioned before, obviously, you know, the most evident wounds are physical, but the psychological wounds are, of course, very significant and when it comes to combat. And when we, the Wounded Soldier Relief Program, is that just for physical wounds or for both?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Galizio, it is specifically intended to help soldiers with their physical needs in terms of cash assistance while they are in treatment for their recovery from their physical wounds. The other issue is, and I'm glad you brought it up, and I won't elaborate it on very much, but it is an issue that... As I spent time with soldiers on the ground in Iraq and talking with them about their experiences in combat, I began to understand the tremendous emotional and mental anguish that some of them were feeling, and realizing that they would continue to feel that probably for many years after they are back home and out of a combat environment. And so I know Representative Boquist worked with us in the military department, and we've ascertained that there is help that will be available to them for a long period of time after they are demobilized. At least that's the current direction that we think is still accurate from the Pentagon in terms of allowing those types of counseling services to be available. So bottom line is, we think we have that covered, as that frankly was one of our legislative concepts we brought forward early. And the Pentagon decided that for the Guard and Reserve component, that they should have access to those mental health counselors for some time afterwards. And I think the current, Representative Boquist, you could probably help me out here, but I think the current thinking is that will be extended for 3 years after demobilization. And that may or may not, Mr. Chairman, Representative Galizio, that may or may not be enough time, but at least it's a good start. And in ensuing years, we can, after we get a better handle on what's really going to happen here, we might be able to further address that as a state.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel?
I don't think you can put a time frame on something like that. I strongly, strongly believe that anyone that's ever been in a combat situation, you see things and you experience things that no one else can understand or ever will understand unless they've been there.
Yeah.
You carry that with you and you build a wall to combat that. sometimes that wall breaks down. And it may be 10 years, it may be 15 years, it may be a smell, it may be a sound, it may be something that you see that triggers that. But it's always there. So I don't think you can put a time frame on it.
And Mr. Chairman and Representative Esquivel, I couldn't disagree with you in any way. One of my cousins was a Marine in Vietnam in 66 and 67, in a combat Marine. And I've had many conversations with him about that issue. And he still today is at times dealing with those issues and has had counseling in the last few years of his life, so many years after the experience of Vietnam. And I would fully agree with you. At least the federal government is recognizing that their prior policy of basically these services being unavailable to you 90 days after demobilization, that prior policy was inadequate. At least in some small way, they're making some advancement by offering it for the next 3 years. I don't think it's going to be enough either. And it would be my hope that in ensuing legislative sessions, we can make those services available as the state of Oregon. And I got to tell you, I think we have a moral obligation to do that. We ask our citizen soldiers to go to war and then leave them high and dry when we come home, and I don't think that's appropriate. And I think many of us on a bipartisan basis, in fact, I would say all of us in this legislative body and the governor, have recognized that we need to step up to the plate for our Guard and Reserve who've gone to the wall for us. And I'm very proud of all of you and all of my colleagues and the governor for being willing to recognize that we need to increase their benefits. We need to do things to help them when they get home.
As you say, Representative Kraft, this is a good start. Representative Boquist, recognized?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. And I agree with Representative Esquivel, and I know that Representative Colopin have discussed this before, and she can pipe in at some point. But the mental health issue is something we're going to have to continue to work on during the interim to address. And I know Representative Kraft will be assisting that and all the members of the Veterans Committee. We have not solved this problem. All we have done is extended the time and found a way to address it at least during the next 2 years. But we have to have a comprehensive solution.
Thank you, Representative. Further comments, members of the committee? Representative Boquist, you have a motion to make?
Sure. I move that House Bill 3333 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
The motion is to move House Bill 3333, as previously engrossed, to the House floor with a due pass motion. Is there any discussion to the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none and recognizing Representative Berger is away on other House business and excused. There being no objection to the motion, House Bill 3333, as previously engrossed, will move to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Krupp, would you like to carry that, or are you and Representative Nelson?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the honor, and I would love to carry the bill. I would also love to have Representative Nelson and Representative Boquist also be added to that.
Do you want three carriers sharing 3 minutes apiece? Well, why don't you let Representative Nelson go, and then the two of you can talk.
As Mr. Chairman, as long as everyone agrees to not yield any additional time to any three of us,
okay,
that would be fine.
With some fear and trepidation, the chair allows Representatives Nelson, Krupp and Boquist in that order, if that's satisfactory, to go ahead and carry that bill to the floor. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3333. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 944, as previously engrossed. Mazin? And there are amendments to the 944-A4 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 944A comes to us from the Senate, but for that from the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board. From this point on, we'll call it SMCB. And what the bill does in a capsule, if you will, puts the process by which it governs the different violations or some of the problems in industry, expands it to the issue of selling and allowing for merchandise and service that otherwise is not fully disclosed to the cost or the full cost of these services. Additionally, it allows or asks for the interference basically of the Department of Justice or other state agencies into complaints and issues that are not within the authority of the board to deal with. And finally, the board is asked to come up with administrative rules in order to govern or talk about and make more of the notification prior to the sale type of regulations as it sees fit. And of course, I need to mention that there is a penalty in existing current laws of $1,000 per violation, you know, for each violation, or the suspension or revocation of a license if those infractions occur. And from that, in the current law, you also have the manner by which those civil penalties would be going to the general fund and working into the service of the practice. Now, from the SMS on the Senate side, there obviously has been a lot of discussions from proponents and opponents of the bill, and it seems like also many issues have come up with different amendments. The ones that you've talked about, Mr. Chair, is the A4 amendment, and the A4 amendment basically tries to recognize that all these issues and discussions are truly numerous to resolve, and it tries to put to rest all these discussions for the time being and then bring them back in the 2007 session. In other words, resurrect the issue in the 2007 session.
Thank you very much. We have signed up for public testimony David Coe, who is the Executive Director, Mortuary and Cemetery Board, and Chuck Roberts from the Funeral Consumers Alliance of Oregon, and Cheryl Pellegrini, I'm sorry if I'm saying that wrong, from the Department of Justice. Now, and then as well as Diane Bassett-Pohl, who is a member of the Mortuary Cemetery Board and also the Mayor of Plattsmanine. Welcome, Mayor Bassett-Pohl. Now, let's see. Mayor Bassett-Pohl, would you like to come forward? Certainly with David Coe, you traveled the furthest, so we better hear from you first. So.
Thank you, Chair Butler and committee. It's indeed a pleasure to be here. I'm a member of the Mortuary Cemetery Board. I have been since 1997 or 98. However, I've been actively engaged in this industry since 1984. I have testimony here that will briefly give my history, but Senate Bill 944 did not come to you as a result of the Mortuary Cemetery Board. This was a suggestion by a citizen and part of the industry that subsequently came to you with a heading on it that pertained to the Oregon Mortuary Cemetery Board. So I am here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 944. As I understand it, the board, we voted to, if there were further work to be done on this particular issue, if it was of issue, then we would participate in a task force in order to address this particular situation.
Mayor Bassett-Pohl, you're referring specifically to the original bill that relates to the sale of markers and other funeral paraphernalia then?
Yes, sir. It would be the A engrossed version.
Okay.
That's the last one that I have.
Okay.
My experience, with this industry is over a 20-year period. And I got interested in this industry after I was kind of a victim of the Almsburg issue in 1984, where my husband was found to be one of the rotting bodies in his mortuary. Subsequent to that, the laws were changed in 1985 due to that occurrence and have been in place since 1985. And I was on a task force with not only industry representatives but also state agencies to make the death laws in Oregon the strongest in the nation. I've had calls from Boston, Massachusetts, and all over years ago wanting a copy of our death laws. So I really do, where I oppose the bill, I really do ask you to consider that the Mortuary Cemetery Board is a strong board consisting of 11 members, 4 of which are volunteer public members, 7 of which are industry members. We've worked very hard since 1985 collectively with the industry and the citizens and the board to have the best death laws that we can possibly have. And I'm here to answer any questions, to be to do anything that I can do now and in the future to begin to be available to anybody.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor Vassipol. Did you testify when before the Senate when 944 was up in the Senate, Mayor?
Chair Butler, I did not.
Did not, okay. But you are in opposition of the bill the way it presently stands.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Questions of Mayor Vassipol from members of the committee? Thank you very much, Mayor, for having come, and we appreciate your participation as a layperson on the board, as a public member of the board.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hass.
I may have one question about the amendments to this bill, which replace it. And one of the provisions of that would increase the number of board members representing the funeral industry by 1, as I understand, and reduce the number of members of the board representing the public. Do you think that's a good idea?
I do not, Representative Hess. This was tried before, back in 1991, I believe. It was suggested that the board be reduced. I have not seen that dash amendment. As of yesterday, it was not available to me. We have gone over this in 1991. It was suggested again in 95 by the industry. But what we have such a well-balanced board. Right now we have 3 of the 4 public members that are on there. And they are we have a former trailblazer, for instance. We have me, who's a mayor of the city. We have an accountant. And the rest of the remainder of the board is from industry. There are a number of representatives from the funerals, from embalmers, from cemeteries, from special districts, so that when there is an issue that comes before that board, we have a very broad view and are able to objectively come to a decision. I've been on that board, as I say, since 1998, and I don't remember but a handful of split decisions on anything, because we have been able to talk among us. We who are lay people listen very carefully to industry people, and we're able to bring a balanced view. I would be very much opposed to that quotient changing, because it has worked so very well.
And Mayor Poole, you've been on since 1998, and I understand from the statute that it provides for a maximum of 2 terms. Is that right?
That's correct, Chair
Butler.
And
you said that there are 3 of the 4 members that are public right now?
That's right, Chair Butler. We have not, as I understand it.
We have 4 public members.
Okay.
There's 4
right.
Public members.
And you said that in 1991 there was an attempt to change, and in 1995 there was an attempt to change?
There was. It was suggested by the industry that number change. In 1991, Representative, I can't remember, from Dallas, was able to get the bill killed. And in 1995, Senator Kinnemer did not agree with that, and the bill went nowhere.
Okay, thank you. This Dash 1 amendment, Dash 4 amendment, have you had an opportunity to receive a copy of that?
Chair Butler, I have not.
Okay. Yeah, we probably ought to have you receive a copy of that, because what it does is it provides that during the interim of the regular sessions that the Assembly directs the State Mortuary and Cemetery Board to study the funeral industry issues relating to the board makeup, as well as the appropriate minimum staff training levels and standards for members that are, or for board compliance and the investigation staffs. So those are two of the issues that should be reported back based upon the Dash A4 amendments. And then this bill has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means, the House Budget Committee.
Chair Butler, I would be in opposition to this for a couple different reasons. Having, like I say, been involved in this unwittingly for 20 years, I can tell you that this industry, above all others, is one that each and every one of us will have to deal with at some point in our lives. We can't, I mean, I can not hire an attorney if I don't want to. I cannot hire any of the other professions if I don't want to. But there comes a time in our life we have to hire these folks. And for that reason, I personally, and I am testifying on a very personal level now, if I might, Chair Butler, personally, the reason that I have stayed involved with this for 20 years is because I want to see the industry as it has been since 1985, when so laboriously these laws were put into place. This board was put into place with much thought from the industry and from the state. If there are issues as far as staff training, certainly the board is always open to suggestions, and we try with everything we have to comply with not only any state mandate or whatever, and we're more than happy to look at that. But as far as changing the makeup of the board, it has worked. It's not broken. It's not perfect. There is no committee probably or board that is. If there is, I'd like to serve on it. But even my city council, we occasionally have areas that can use improvement. But the makeup and the composition and the numbers of the board have worked, and I very respectfully request that those numbers not be changed.
Well, you understand that we're not changing any numbers. It would have to be you and your board, and interim, you folks would use that as a discussion point. We're not changing your board today. We're not doing anything of that nature. What we're saying is that this bill, if the A4 amendment were to pass, that what would happen is that you would have an opportunity to come back to the next legislature if you found that there were any additions or modifications that needed to be made in this regard. You understand that?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
I want you to know that we're not voting to change your board.
Thank you.
We don't have that authority.
Mr. Chair.
All right. Yes, Representative Hatz.
I just want to thank the mayor for coming. This is outstanding, your work that you do, and it's very helpful that you came here and gave us your perspective. I guess I'd like to inquire as to the origin of the Dash 4 amendments.
The Dash 4 amendments were ordered by myself, and we'll get into that as we hear from the director. And I see we've got, as I say, the part of their legal staff, Department of Justice, and then some other funeral consumer group here. So I want to hear from staff, and then from the executive director, and then we'll hear from the other folks, and then I'd like to go ahead and work this a little bit further.
Sure.
Further, yes, Representative Lopez.
I just want to get the mayor to clarify. He said the original Senate Bill 944 you're opposed to. Is that correct?
Yes, Representative.
Yes, follow up.
And you indicated that neither yourself nor the mortuary board testified to this bill over in the Senate?
be testifying?
I did.
Okay.
I can clarify.
Okay. Representative Boquist, our executive director did testify. The board members did not testify, and he could clarify if that's all right.
Okay. We'll have further questions of the mayor. Thank you very much, Mayor Master Cole. Let's see. David, we have you up here. Is Cheryl from Department of Justice, is she assigned to? Okay.
Chair Butler, Ms. Pellegrini is with the Department of Justice, and I believe she is here to testify on the substance of the original Senate Bill 944, not anything to do with these amendments.
Okay. And David, your comment was that you felt this was way beyond the board's scope and competence relative to the underlying.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, for the record, my name's David Coe. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. As the bill was originally introduced, it contained certain provisions that would have required the board to develop a certain level of expertise with antitrust law that was way beyond our
capability. Let's have Ms. Pellegrini come forward, and then she can testify to that as well.
Okay.
Go ahead. Continue, David.
I have not yet seen the Dash 4 amendments.
You'll have an opportunity to look at them as she then comes forward. Okay. Ms. Pellegrini, please.
Would you like me to continue?
Why don't we just go ahead and have her testify relative to the Dash. Have you seen the Dash 4s?
Mr. Chair, just now.
Okay. But you're here to testify on the underlying bill.
That is correct.
And that's the information Dave was just giving us relative to the antitrust laws and those kinds of things.
Mr. Chair, the testimony that...
Why don't you go ahead and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you.
Pellegrini.
My name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice, Financial Fraud, Consumer Protection, and I serve as attorney in charge of that section. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the purpose of the department's testimony on this bill was actually a very narrow issue, and that was as to whether or not it may have a fiscal impact on the Department of Justice. And I would be testifying as to the version contained in the AIM Brooks printed bill. So
okay.
That's what I came prepared to address. I can try to address additional issues if you would like me to do so.
Thank you. The proposed A4 amendment would delete all of pages 2 and 3, as well as lines 4 through 26 of page 1. So it wouldn't be any longer in play. I don't intend to move because my prior conversations on May 17th with Director Coe was that he just felt that it was beyond the board's competence and resources to go into these kinds of things. So I didn't anticipate moving any of the currently A engrossed version.
Well, if that was the chair's intent, then we would not be taking a position on the A4s.
Okay.
Because that it appears that this would be a policy matter as between the Assembly and the board.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Pellegrini. Yes, Representative Berger is recognized.
Mr. Chair, you indicated that this bill has a subsequent referral to the Budget Committee. Is that because of the possible...
Originally, it had a ways and means implication. It will have a fiscal implication if the board spends anything... if the board spends anything, it'll have a fiscal implication. But it's anticipated that in its regular work, the State Mortuary and Cemetery, down line 6, State Mortuary and Cemetery Board shall study the funeral industry issues relating to the items that are reflected there. That is the makeup of the board. They'll talk about what happens if you decrease one of the public members and increase then on item C between 8 and or A and B and lines 8 through 13 change the makeup of the board. They will study that and make recommendations, as well as in C lines 14 and 15 to make recommendations what they think that minimum professional training standards should be for the compliance and investigation staffs. So that's if there is a fiscal, it's all within the agency at that point. Is that responsive to your question?
Yes, but you did indicate that this bill does have
a subsequent referral. Yes.
Okay.
Representative Riley.
One question for the folks on the board. Are these things in the amendment A4, the number of members on the board, the results if you changed it, the minimum professional training standards, are these things that you folks think about periodically now?
Representative Riley, the makeup of the board as far as public members versus industry members, yes, it has been discussed before. And it has been determined that this is a right balance. In other words, the public members don't have a majority. The industry members do, but it just seems to work. As far as the minimum professional training standards, we do have criteria of hiring, and we do have and if this needs to be revisited, the board certainly would be happy to revisit that if there's something that we're missing. But we do have standards for our employees.
Follow up, Representative Riley.
Do you feel that you need a bill to tell you to study this?
Representative Riley, no, I don't, quite honestly. The board does its work in the dark, so to speak, due to all the confidentiality laws. I can tell you that 2 years ago, the board, through an investigator who did went to Southern Oregon, found that $5 million worth of trust funds, pre-need trust funds, that were already paid into those trust funds by hundreds of folks, mm-hmm. had been stolen. We were the lead agency to say this isn't right. And it took us 2 years to build up a system working with several state agencies and the folks in Southern Oregon. And we finally did get a program by which those people will be made whole in their services. This had a very small place in the Oregonian and a very small place in the Southern Oregon newspaper, but the hundreds of folks who would have been otherwise victims of this, it made a big difference in their life. And so we feel that we are, if there are minor things that the board needs to look at, we have always been open, bring them to us, and we most certainly will look at whatever we need to. That is the way that this board has worked. It's the reason I have stayed on the board. If it had any less integrity, I would not be on it. Thank you, Representative.
Representative Boquist, recognize.
Mr. Chair, would the AG's office care to comment? I believe I heard someone use the antitrust word here a little while ago or something along that. Is there some antitrust issue here I'm missing, or are you just here to talk about the fiscal?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, there have been complaints that have been received by, I think, possibly the board, and by the Department of Justice, that some cemeteries around the state are engaging in conduct that may constitute antitrust violations of a tying nature. And what that means is that the allegation is that cemeteries are requiring that a consumer either purchase certain goods from the cemetery in order to then be able to purchase and place a person in a plot, or if they are going to purchase the goods from another seller, then to pay a fee. And so the issue before the Attorney General, and I'm sorry because it's something we're starting to look at, and a little bit limited in what I can tell you, because it's in the nature of an inquiry at this point by our office. But essentially the issue is whether or not that requirement of either buying goods from the cemetery owner or paying a fee, if not, constitutes a violation of state or federal antitrust laws.
But we've got a representation on the board of three of the 11 board members are cemetery owners, operators, or directors. and the board hasn't heard anything about the antitrust issue?
Chair Butler, we haven't had, we've heard of the antitrust issues in anecdotal fashion. We have not had a complaint about an antitrust issue since, I believe, 1993. I went through and looked through our case files to see if I couldn't identify them. 93, and for a couple of years before that, there were complaints that came in from so-called third-party monument dealers. Those complaints were forwarded to the Department of Justice. There had been prior legal action taken, and there were decisions made by the court, and I believe there was even a consent order that the Attorney General entered into with a number of facilities. And because of those situations, this was a similar situation, and I believe it was handled within the framework of the original consent order. The issue that arose with respect to Senate Bill 944 does again come to the legislature from a third-party monument dealer. There are, if you look at literature nationwide, you will find no end of anti-competitive scare tactics that happen all the time. We haven't had a complaint about one of those to the board. I'm not saying that they don't exist, and certainly I believe that if there was a consumer protection issue that came before the Mortuary and Cemetery Board and the board identified that as a problem, the board would want to work with interested parties and stakeholders to try and craft some form of a solution. This bill, as it was written, was so confusing originally that we were being asked to write administrative rules relative to the statute. We didn't understand the proposed statute well enough to think that we could start to write administrative rules. So I know this has all been taken out of the bill, so I'm providing this information for the committee.
I just
wanted
to follow up, Dave. As Mayor Bassett Poll has indicated that consumers were defrauded of something in the city of $5 million. Was that handled through the Department of Justice?
Yes, together.
Okay.
There were a number of different agencies involved. The Department of Justice had several divisions involved, and the board was involved in the bankruptcy court. The person who ultimately fashioned a 25-pound Byzantine global settlement agreement was federal bankruptcy Judge Frank Alley, who just got disgusted with all the parties involved and said, look, you're going to come here and sit down and figure out that part of it.
Okay.
The criminal side was also, the DA was involved because someone ultimately went to jail.
Okay. Is that responsive to your question, Representative? Further follow-up?
Yeah, follow up on that. I guess I'm just looking for a comment from the panel here, and I look at the original engrossed A, or the A engrossed Senate bill, and it's quite prescriptive in that at least 27 members of the Senate said there's a problem, and they want something done. And then I look at the A4, which hasn't been fully explained, which says, okay, we're not going to do anything yet, just go back and study it. I'm kind of curious, and the mayor did not testify in the Senate, but maybe somebody can tell me there were 27 senators that thought there was a problem. So, and now we hear everything's perfect. So I'm challenged here, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Butler, Representative Boquist, there were a number of efforts to get together, and the central problem was that the problem could not be specifically identified. We just couldn't get our minds wrapped around what the problem was, and if you can't specifically identify the problem, how do you identify the solution?
Wasn't this a problem that occurred several years before you said?
Well, I think the major proponent of the bill was a man by the name of Carl Plass. I think he would tell you that there are current and ongoing problems, but we couldn't articulate them in any specific way. So what my board did was vote to oppose the A engrossed version of the bill having to do with these anti-competitive issues, and instead recommended that the board, the Mortuary and Cemetery Board, establish a forum where interested parties could come together and attempt to identify the problem and also provide them for a forum once the problem has been identified to see if the interested parties couldn't craft some sort of a solution. And if they could do that, the board would support that. The A engrossed version of this bill has essentially dissolved, as I understand it, if you take out 1 through 26 and delete the next two pages, it's essentially gone.
You're absolutely correct there, and I guess that it still raises some additional questions, and that is that having discussed this with Senator Ringo, who brought the bill before the commission or the Committee on Judiciary at the request of Carl Plass, evidently his comment, Senator Ringo's comment to me is, this has been a long-term ongoing problem in the industry, and you're acting like this is the first time it's raised its head, but you've told us that it has cropped up in history, that it's come and gone and come and gone. Mr. Plass says that it's been a long-term problem.
Chair Butler, I can only tell you about those complaints that we had since 1993. If there is a specific problem, rather than a broad antitrust issue, we could try and craft some sort of solution to it, but we weren't able to identify a specific problem. For the reasons for why it's been handled the way it has, I would have to refer you back to Senator Ringo and his office. I can't speak to that.
Okay. Representative Boquist, please follow up.
Thank you. Without divulging anything, can you tell us how many complaints you've dealt with in the last year and how many are still pending?
Chair Butler, Representative Boquist, are you referring to antitrust complaints or complaints in general?
Complaints in general, Mr. Chair.
And we receive anywhere from 75 to 100 complaints a biennium, I believe. But we have a current backlog of about 130 complaints that remain uninvestigated. Does that answer your question?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
How many in the backlog?
I think about 130.
That have no action taken on them
no.
at this point?
Chair Butler, no action has been taken. There may be some progress in the investigation, but the board has not yet made a decision on those cases, is the best way I can.
But some investigation is in process.
Yes.
Okay. Chair.
Representative Olson?
How far are we talking about for investigation? I mean, what's the longest one that's extended out?
I don't have that information. We have some cases that are relatively old. I mean, I think we've got cases that are 5 years old. Chair Butler, Representative Olson, is that?
Follow up, Mr.
Please follow up.
You have some cases that are 5 years old that are still pending?
Chair Butler, Representative Olson, I think that's probably true.
Any older than 5 years?
Chair Butler, I can't tell you. I can elaborate a little bit on that. Our staff and resources are limited. Some of the cases we get involved in are incredibly complex. We have just gotten word from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that a case that we started years ago, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed a dismissal order that was made by a judge here in federal district court. That case was heard by the board, went to a contested case hearing. We prepared a judicial review record. It went to the Oregon Court of Appeals. It went to the Oregon Supreme Court. Another suit was filed in federal court, and it went all the way to the Court of Appeals. The case that Mayor Pohl was referring to went on from 98, and just this week I was still responding to certain issues having to do with the Kern case. What we try to do is prioritize. We had a case recently that was relatively high profile in the media, and we managed to complete the investigation of that case, I think, almost within a month or 6 weeks. The reason for giving attention to that case rather than prioritizing some of the old ones is in that particular case, there was the potential that harm was continuing. In some of these old cases, if there was any damage, whatever harm there might have been ended, and there isn't any potential for greater harm. In some of those cases, it's a simple administrative matter of getting the investigative report to the board. These aren't cases from 5 years ago where it looks as though the board is going to take action. I doubt that there are very many old cases where there are serious issues that where the board is going to sanction or discipline or take someone's license. They're ones that have fallen in behind as far as priority because they're not cases like these other ones that we deal with immediately.
Can you do this for us, please, David? I'm sure we're going to have some questions coming out of this, but I would like to have you tell us what the oldest cases that you have are and when the files were opened up so that we'll have that on the record. Mayor Vestfold, you.
Chair Butler, being this, I've been around the industry or this board a long time, I can tell you there were periods where we have been very, very cautious about ever raising license fees. We haven't raised them. And the board has, or the staff has run pretty lean and mean at times. And it's astounding how many issues come up. You think that maybe it's one or two a month. It's not. It's a lot of issues that come up. And for a while, we ran very short-staffed. And we... the board then addressed to David to get this backlog caught up, and we did ask that certain things happen so that the worst of the cases came before us, and the ones that were less, and we just kind of prioritized them back so that we were able to accommodate anything that had to do with vital public process right away, as soon as we could, and that's why the backlog. It's because we haven't had a license fee raise, and for a while we ran very short staffed.
David, can you tell us what percentage of your total operating comes from license fees versus the death filing fee? I believe that the death filing fee has continued to raise over this period of time, and there's still a bill in right now.
Chair Butler, I have that information in my briefcase from our budget document.
Okay,
but the last time,
I should say some fee does come from the death.
The death certificate filing fee was last raised a generation ago in 1985.
Okay,
the license fees until this past year, license fees were last raised in 1993. And then in 2004, there was an interim license fee increase, and that was the first license fee increase since 1993. So we did raise license fees in 2004, effective November of 2004.
So it's just been from the last year and a half or so that you, or the last year, I guess.
License fee.
Okay.
Yeah.
License fee increased in 2004.
I believe it was effective November 1, 2004, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. But
that was a partial, that's part of a compromise. That's half of a proposal to resolve a revenue shortfall. The board's been facing a revenue shortfall since about 1999, and that license fee increase is one half of a compromise that was worked out with the industry to resolve the revenue shortfall. The other half of that compromise is Senate Bill 53, which does propose to raise the death certificate filing fee by $3. And that fee has not... At the moment, it has not been raised since 1985.
Okay. But there's obviously a lot more people dying in Oregon today than there were in 1985.
Mr. Chair?
Is that right?
There are more people dying in Oregon now than there were in 1985.
Right. So it's based upon population as well. Representative?
Thank you. From a consumer perspective, isn't it kind of in the mortuary and cemetery owner's best interest to keep those license fees down if the result is these complaints are not investigated, particularly those who might practice in an unscrupulous way?
Representative Hass, I believe so.
Okay.
My response is that seems like that system should change then, because it seems rather obvious that this is a set up in kind of an anti-consumer way, or in a best case, one that doesn't really protect the consumers the way it should.
Representative Hass, I do believe that we protect the consumer, even though we do run lean and mean, and we run with a staff. If we had more revenue, we would have, of course, more staff. But we have been addressing consumer problems all along as quickly as we can. Those are prioritized as we go along. But I think that for the staff that we have, the responsibility that we have, you know, we're not a fraternal organization. We're a regulatory agency. And I think they are not popular. Mm-hmm. However, we work closely with the industry on things that we do. But we also protect the consumer. We have a double, we kind of have a double responsibility of not only working with the industry toward, and 95% of the industry wants to work with us, has worked with us. We've had multiple task force that have gone forward. So we're not only charged with keeping a healthy industry and protecting them from unscrupulous folks, but also to protect, not to protect the public, but to help the public, to protect them and to help them through a process.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Boquist. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to follow up on
please.
Representative Riley's question. We talked about the training program and so on and so forth and now this other information. Could you just briefly explain what is the level of training, what is the level of experience, and what is the tenure with your agency of your investigators?
Chair Butler, Representative Boquist, this industry is rather unusual. There is no pool of qualified applicants out there that we can choose from. There is no pool of mortuary and cemetery investigators. The people that we select for these positions, as far as prerequisites, are those that have the requisite investigative background. We have an investigator who's been with us for 2 months now. She's an attorney. She's not working with us as an attorney, but she worked for Liberty Mutual doing investigative type work and for OLCC. Our other investigator at the moment is a former captain with the Portland Police Bureau, who also happens to have a master's degree and worked with in the chief's office. So those folks have the requisite investigative backgrounds. Our compliance manager used to teach that sort of thing in college. So they have the requisite investigative background. The background that's hard to come by, that we don't have a lot of resources to go to in terms of training, has to do with the nature of mortuary and cemetery law, which is something that by definition we have to provide in-house. We have done things like we've gone out to what's called Dodge Days at Mount Hood Community College School of Funeral Service Education, where two of our investigators watched a seminar having to do with embalming and those sorts of things. But for the most part, it's on-the-job training with respect to the nature of the rules and the laws that apply to mortuaries and cemeteries. Representative Boquist, we have had some turnover problem in the compliance positions. We've had some fairly good success in keeping staff in the licensing specialist position and in the office manager position, and I've been with the board for 9 years, and our current compliance manager came from an investigator position and has been with us, I believe, about 2.5 years. But we have had persistent turnover among those investigator inspector positions. The number of them have gone on to investigator 3 positions elsewhere in state government. It very much hurts us when an investigator with such a small staff takes a promotion to another job in state government. It hurts us almost in two ways. When you bring someone new on board, a qualified staff person is taken away from their regular duties in order to bring this other person up to speed.
So you have staff training staff?
We do. And so we also have had a problem.
An investigator that has 9 months worth of training is training the person with 2 months worth of training.
Actually, the compliance manager,
who has 2.5 years with the agency,
would be training the new investigator. We've also had a problem due to the revenue shortfall. The board lost a position during the last legislative session. We had, at that point, we had a person who had been with the board about 6 months, just long enough to pass his probationary period. He was beginning to become somewhat productive when the board was required to lay him off, when he went and got another job, when the emergency board later, by virtue of this interim license fee increase, returned the board authority for a position, we hired a new person, and we essentially lost the advantage of the person we trained for 6 months, and we start all over again. So we have suffered from that from that staff turnover in those compliance positions. There's no question about that.
Well, colleagues, I'm going to share with you now that that is the reason why this issue came forward. I was concerned that that we have people that have been with us for a few months, training people who have been with us for a few days on this particular board. And thus you'll see in items 14 and 15, the one thing we would like the board to address amongst themselves, this isn't with legislative oversight, amongst themselves, some discussion of the minimum professional training. If the embalming school, and when David, when you and I have talked for several hours now in meetings, this is the first I'd heard that your members were attending anything that had to do with the operation of an actual embalming or those kinds of things. But colleagues, amongst the letters which I have received when I asked for amongst my constituents after I had some constituents who had expressed some concern about the new investigators on this board that went out and were trying to enforce building code laws. Building codes had directed certain things to be done, and the board had directed other things to be done. And amongst the things that were to be done were that the folks went out at any rate, when I testified before the Ways and Means Committee relative to my concern about these folks that were not trained as building inspectors and that were new on the job relative to the investigations of mortuaries or cemeteries or embalming or cremation programs, my concern was that I then started receiving some letters back. And the story goes on from there. However, let me just share with you one of my concerns about some folks that are receiving on-the-job training. And I did share this with the board chair yesterday, and I'd like you to just step back, if you would, in your own professions for just a moment. And I know how I'd feel as an accountant to have somebody who is new to the profession and had never taken the courses that came in and to tell me what they would like me to do. But in this process, one report comes back that two inspectors arrived for our annual inspection, and these are typically as the director indicated to me, these are typically surprise inspections, but I'm not sure how you're going to surprise folks once they hit town in a certain part of town and the word gets out in a hurry. So the secretary had to put all the phones on the answering service on hold, and then one staff person had to come back from a church to provide the additional information for the investigators. I will read now directly from the letter. It says, "The rude and disrespectful manner in which they treat funeral home personnel is very unnecessary and distasteful. We are very willing to cooperate because of our desire to be in compliance. However, our staff should be treated with respect." I'll go on the letter now. "Upon finishing the inspection of our first funeral home, the inspectors copied some of our arrangement files to take with them and left to go to our second funeral home. Shortly thereafter, our secretary received a call from the inspectors. They had misplaced the copied files, wondered if they had left them in our office, in our first office. It was confirmed that no copies were left. So they decided they must have left them at the restaurant where they'd had lunch. They never called to tell us what had happened to those copies, which had contained confidential information of our clients." Now colleagues, I read that and I shared that with the board president yesterday. I'm not going to place myself in your professions, that whether it be a teacher, a cop, or other professionals. But I know how I would feel if someone who had graduated with a degree in high school had whatever kind of a degree in college, but no degree in accounting, came to my office and said, I'm having a problem with this, that, or the other. I want some of your confidential files. And, oh, by the way, I don't think you're running your mortuary the way that I think it should be done. Another concern came with some folks that had been fined or a proposed sanction relative to leaving equipment, the embalming equipment and the sanitary solution for too long. There are no board rules, no administrative rules dealing with how long disinfectant can be left on these kinds of tools. Obviously, a scalpel has to be sharp and those kinds of things, but there just was a concern, a general concern, about people who have been on the job for a few days being trained by people who have been on the job for a few months. And all of this with an entire compliance staff of something in the vicinity of less than a year in total average time. And then following my presentation to the Ways and Means with a concern that I had about the issue dealing with a building inspection issue that I thought that were being conducted by, or that my constituents in Eastern Oregon felt were being conducted by folks that weren't building inspections and building inspectors. Then my two of my Eastern Oregonian folks received telephone calls within hours of my presentation before the Ways and Means, and that may have been coincidental, but I have some folks that are concerned about retaliation. This is their livelihood. These are these folks' livelihood, and I'm concerned about folks who are looking for a job when they found this one that potentially could be engaged in outrageous conduct. And so, based upon that, I have I've requested this bill with this amendment to ask the board if they wouldn't please consider taking it upon themselves to take a look at your at the board makeup itself, and Mayor Bassett Hull, and all respect to your good service and many years of involvement, I am concerned that perhaps it's time for us to move on. And while there are 11 members on the board, three of those represent the cemetery industries, whether they be from the municipal cemeteries, or whether they be from privately owned cemeteries, or whether they be from other kinds of nonprofit cemeteries, and board members serving from those. The information that I've got from the director is that the actual time spent at cemeteries can be from anywhere from an hour to 3 hours in a biennium. Any way you slice it, that's no more than about 1,000 hours a year, 2,000 hours per biennium from a staff of, I believe, six people total on your staff. But I'm concerned that that there are three members of the 11 members that represent cemeteries, and only four that represent the actual morticians, the embalmers, the crematoriums, the funeral service directors, and the mortuaries themselves. So I've got a number of folks that are not being represented, and it looks to me like, and that's why I've asked you, David, for additional information relative to financial, that the board is not represented necessarily in the way that your licensees are. I understand from prior information that you've given me that there are somewhere in the vicinity of 190 funeral establishments in the state of Oregon, approximately 59 to 60 crematories, and 12 immediate disposition facilities. That's about 100 or 260, 270 perhaps, total facilities, with 491 operating cemeteries that take a very small amount of the overall time. So that's why I have asked for, and then, colleagues, let me just share with you that that I've tabulated and had staff tabulate some of the concerns that have been expressed. The majority of the concerns, I thought, would be, and the majority of my time had been involved with regard to the questions about inspections and investigations ongoing by the board. But the complaints come out about evenly split between the board themselves, the board members themselves, and the staff. Four against staff, eight against inspections, and four about rules, with 15 about the board. Concerns about conduct of the board itself. So, and the number one item that appears relative to the complaints and concerns about staff is inconsistency, and I'm thinking that inconsistency deals in part with staff training, as well as the inspectors. Number one item, inconsistency, inconsistent, they're difficult, unapproachable, Gestapo-like, and I'm sorry to have to use that term here, and relative to the rules and statutes and how they're applied, inconsistent interpretation by the inspectors and the board. And colleagues, for that reason, I have asked for the dash A4 amendments that you see before you today. And I'm just very concerned that I'd like to have the board go back and have an opportunity to examine itself and examine particularly with regard to the training, what appropriate minimum professional training standards should be applied and required of the compliance and investigation staff. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm after hearing what you just told us, I'm in agreement that there needs to be some looking by the board about these matters. But one thing that I would, as a business analyst for several years, one of the things that I would recommend is looking at maybe a bit more of a career path for investigators on this board. It sounds to me like one of the reasons that they can't keep staff is because they have no place to promote them to. And with a career path, this would probably correct itself.
And Representative, I appreciate that because that was one of the items that I'd hoped that they would discuss in this process would be the issue relative to and bringing all of the people to the table. There's an industry out here that is not at the table at this particular point, and that industry needs to be at the table relative to the outreach of the entire profession and any continuing professional education. And that was one of the comments that I had in a two-hour meeting I had with the executive director, was I'd like to know about the continuing professional education. There's none required. There's none in the state of Oregon. 22 to 26 states require some minimal amount of continuing professional education. I mean, I can't prepare your tax return on an annual basis, let alone embalm your dear departed one without, here we are with no continued professional education. Representative Hass is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your points are well taken. Nobody likes overzealous regulators or obnoxious regulators, I guess. And there needs to be, I think, a good balance. You know, on the other hand, nobody should ever have to go through the experience that the mayor went through 20 years ago. And I think that's what you might end up with if you have, dare I say, all the foxes guarding the hen house. And so I think there should be a balance. And to me, what it looks like, there may be complaints against the board, but I heard 130 cases that aren't being investigated for lack of funds and all various other things, and a huge backlog that had even stopped our resident police officer here short. And so that to me sounds like a much bigger problem than gripes that the board is being unfair or that regulators were not the most polite. So I mean there should be a balance, and I would hesitate to lurch forward to say let's load up this board with more cemetery owners.
And I appreciate that, and I wouldn't take it upon myself to say that the blend is wrong, but I am concerned that there are professions that are not represented, while we have public members that are zealous about perhaps other issues. Representative Boquist.
Mr. Chair, it appears to me, what we're asking for, or what hypothetically the amendment for, is asking them to do a self-assessment, look at this, and they've heard what, obviously at least the director has heard what 27 members of the Senate said. I'm still not clear what they said, but they said something and they didn't like what it was, and we got to where we are today. And likewise, I think, you know, we can talk about the fees, so on and so forth, but the first recommendation of making a fee increase or an increase comes from the board itself, so I think it needs to be an overall broad self-assessment, and we're at least the way I look at it says we would be just telling them you need to do this assessment yourself, and then come back and tell us something.
Thank you very much, Representative Berger. I'm sorry. Did you not have your hand up?
No, I did not.
Sorry. I'm sorry. I thought I saw a hand. I'm sorry. I beg your pardon. Okay, and colleagues, that's I just wanted to make sure that my involvement was abundantly clear to each of you. This has been going on now for just about 2 weeks, and I'm very, very concerned about making certain that the board does control itself, that it does have the necessary oversight of your executive director and your staff, and that's what this is about, Mayor Bassett-Pole, and it's not directed. As a matter of fact, I was shocked to have the tabulation come back to show that there were concerns about the direction that certain board members were taking this and the process. And some of that deals with some of the regulations and so forth. And in my meetings with Kathy Wentz Phelps, I told her that I would try and give her a copy of the information, of the summary information that I've accumulated here, and so that you'll have it as board members. Because I'm very concerned about an issue that I didn't think was a top issue to my constituents, and then when I started receiving information from all parts of the state, Southern Oregon and Portland area, most of the issues are from right here on our doorstep. My constituents weren't necessarily complaining, other than the fact that they just finished a remodel and put the locks on the doors, and then we've got the folks coming in from Salem or from Portland saying, "Hi, I'm from the mortuary board. You got to take these locks and move these around, put a screen up here, and do this." And they're saying, "Hey, wait a minute, the building inspectors won't let us do that." So that was my primary concern, and what brought me to this point.
Representative Butler, I think I speak for every board member when I say, if there are issues, we definitely have not a problem in addressing those issues. We have tried. I have not heard of the, and I will say something very honestly right now. As long as I have been on that board and been around that board, we have been retaliatory to no one. We have, especially in the last 4 years, continued to encourage industry participation, but there's a point where we can't encourage it when it comes to the confidentiality law. When we have an open session meeting, we can't say what we've done. I have seen board members personally take refrigeration units to a mortuary who couldn't afford it and they were out of compliance. Another board member actually went to the mortuary and helped them get their books in shape so that they were in compliance. I have seen board members, and we have bent over backwards in many, many instances to bring people into compliance rather than to punish them, as it were. That has been our job. If there is something that we need to review, most assuredly, be assured, it will be reviewed. As far as the makeup of the board, the reason 1984 happened was it was an industry-driven board, and there was no check and balance.
Thank you very much, Mayor. We also have Chuck Roberts signed up to testify. If there are no further questions here, thank you very much. Chuck? Funeral Consumers Alliance of Oregon. Thank you for waiting patiently.
Chair, Representative Butler, and members of the committee, I wasn't prepared to testify exactly on this point that you brought up, but now that I am here, I want to call your attention to a word that I haven't heard very much since I've been sitting here, and that is the word consumer. And I represent the consumer. I'm president of Funeral Consumers Alliance of Oregon, and we have about 10,000 members. Our mission is to guarantee the public's right to dignified, low-cost, at-death arrangements. So I'm in a position to hear problems and complaints that our members have about the funeral industry. I'm also on the board of Funeral Consumers Alliance, a national organization that is an umbrella organization for 115 affiliates such as the one in Oregon. Its 800 phone number receives an average of 500 calls a month. Half of these calls, an average of 250 calls a month, are from consumers who have complaints about or have had problems with the funeral industry. As a result of what I hear from these two sources, I can say that the consumer wants regulation of the funeral industry and is willing to pay for it. Now, there's been quite a discussion here about the budget of the Mortuary and Cemetery Board and the fact that they had to cut one investigator, the fact that they can't keep investigators there. Without trying to sound too negative about it, I've after listening to Chairman Butler's complaints that the industry has made, there are some complaints about the industry, too. And I think that it should be called to the attention that this is a two-way street here. And, in fact, I have sat on a committee of industry members in which it was stated they didn't think that the Mortuary and Cemetery Board should have any inspectors. So there are two, I guess there are two sides to every case. If the committee wishes, if there's time, I can give examples of specific situations that point up the need for more regulation of the funeral industry. I don't know if you want me to go into that or not.
I would think, Mr. Roberts, that if the amendment is passed to the current Senate bill, that they will be able to review not only the antitrust issues that the original bill had, as well as the suggestion to take a look at the overall makeup of the board and the potential for training and continued education for some of their staff, but also they could then address the other issues that you're bringing up as well. And I would expect that they should address the consumer issues at just as high a level. And so while we appreciate your testimony, I don't want to just cut you short, but I also want to recognize that the board can, and by this directive, can go ahead and examine all of those issues.
I'm aware of that.
Okay, thank you. Further questions of Mr. Roberts?
I have a question, staff.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Roberts.
Thank
we appreciate
you.
It. Thank you for coming and participating with us from the Funeral Consumers Alliance. Question to staff, representative?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify for me that in a board or committee or in a board like this, that's a quasi-independent board like this, is it the board that makes the recommendation for fee increases? How does that process work? I mean, if they have a budget issue and they're self-sustaining quasi, who makes, statutorily, is it the board that makes that recommendation and then it goes through the process? How does that work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Volkers, these could be, the process in general could be either or. Sometimes it is specified in statutes, and other times it's in administrative rule. I don't know particularly for this license if it is that type or the other.
We could follow up at a later point.
We could find out.
We're just trying to figure out what the process is.
Yes. I'll look into that.
Sure.
Thank you very much. And that's that is an issue. Colleagues, any further discussion? We're in a public hearing, and that all the folks that I had signed up, unless there's other folks here that want to testify. Representative Witt, you were here on this bill? Did you want to testify? If you'd like to testify, you're welcome to.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Brad Witt, House District 31, it was not my intention to necessarily testify on this bill. I can in no way claim to be an expert in the death industry, not having been there before.
Hey, you're in the legislature.
With that said, a couple of observations. As Mayor Pohl pointed out, she had the unfortunate experience of not only having her husband's body in a state that none of us would care to have it. Her husband was also buried in a mass grave out on the coast. As a result of that that tragedy, there were laws that were put into effect to help the cemetery mortuary board more effectively regulate the death industry. I think it would be a mistake to change the makeup of the board, because if you take a look at its present structure, the industry is actually in the majority, and we have the industry regulating itself. I think that's a public policy mistake for any board, and I say that probably having served on as many state boards and commissions as anyone in this legislature. I say that from personal experience. And I think that the public's view, the public's voice, and the public interest is the one that ought to be the dominant force on boards and commissions.
So let me understand, Representative Witt. There are seven members from the industry here, three from mortuary or three from cemeteries, four from the cemetery or the mortuaries themselves. Cemeteries and mortuaries, total of seven, and four from the public. You think that ought to be seven from the public and four from the industry?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm not here advocating for a bill that says that, but I think that in the public's interest, that would actually make a very good policy.
Should the same happen with attorneys and medical professions?
Well, I think that on all boards and commissions, if we have the professionals from the industry who are there, capable, knowledgeable, and are able to advise the members of the public, I think we ought to expect that the public members then are competent and capable of acting in the public's interest.
I appreciate that, but I need to understand.
Well, Mr. Chairman, again, I'm testifying on the proposed amendments, and I will allow that. I think that all boards and commissions ought to have a public majority. Yes.
Okay. All right. That's certainly one man's opinion.
Just review my notes here. With regard to the so-called backlog of complaints, I think this is a result of that particular board not having adequate revenue to hire the necessary people to do the kinds of inspections that all of us would like to see take place. I agree entirely with Representative Riley, again, the adequate fees and revenues to establish a career path would make dramatic improvements in the not only in the investigations, but the recruitment and retention of qualified people in this industry. And and lastly, I would say that knowing the Honorable Mayor Pohl, that she is in no way, nor are her colleagues, representative of public members who would be overly zealous in their in the commission of their duties. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to try and answer any questions that the committee might have.
questions of Representative Witt? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Colleagues, we have been in public session, public hearing on Senate Bill 944. And I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 944. And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 944. Colleagues, the A4 amendments are at hand. I would entertain a motion if anyone feels that they were inclined to do so. I'm alone. Representative Esquivel?
Yeah, that's what. Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. The motion is to append the dash A4 amendment to Senate Bill 944. Is there discussion? Representatives? Representative Boquist.
Mr. Chair, just to the point is, what we're asking them to do is do a self-study here.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
That's what I see this as, and it's pretty clear that the board may even want to come back in the next session and say, hey, we need to increase fees to make this happen. Because, mm-hmm.
I don't know. Unless they will care.
You bet.
I'd like to make a comment, and I agree that, you know, as I say, I believe that it's a good thing for them to do a self-study, but I would want to make sure that they include ways to retain and have a career path. And if it takes some increased fees or other revenue to do that, I think they should recommend that.
And that's an excellent suggestion. Further discussion? Representative Hess.
I think it's a good idea for them to do a self-study. I'm not sure they need a law to do that. And I'm a little uncomfortable with this language that asks them to look at the composition of public versus industry members. And we had testimony that that's not necessary. It seems to be working well now. And but beyond that, I don't see that they need a law to tell them to look at ways to do a better job.
And Representative, I appreciate that. This has subsequent reference or referrals to it, so I guess the prior legislation that said you will examine yourself relative to the antitrust issues is but a part of what they can examine in that process too. So I'm concerned that while we are not necessarily in control of what they would examine and study, I think that the volume of mail that I received before the director intervened and asked that, I better leave it there, that what happens is that there's a lot of issues out there that need to be called in. They need to have some outreach. I've talked to the director about that. I'd like to see the board address that. And that's something that certainly could do. Other questions or discussion relative? Yes, Representative Glazio.
For the record, the part that I'm uncomfortable with on the amendment is B, which is prescriptive, which says, it doesn't just say, look at the numbers of board members who represent the industry versus the public. It actually, and I know it doesn't mandate that it change it, but it points in a direction, and I don't feel like that's something that I want to endorse. I mean, the other elements of the amendment make sense to me, but it's just that one kind of prescriptive element in B. So, just for the record.
Okay, the projected result?
Right. Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, so that, in other words, would it be a good thing or bad thing to have more public members, less public members than it would be to have than they presently have? That's what the projected result would be asking of the board. Should they change the makeup? Again, it doesn't mandate that they do it.
I agree.
Okay.
It doesn't mandate it.
Okay. Further discussion? The motion on the floor is to move the A. Let's see. Are we in work session? Did we open work session?
Yes.
We did. Okay. Motion on the floor then is to move the A4 amendment to Senate Bill 944. Are there objections to moving the 944?
Moving the
A4 to 944. Hearing and seeing no objections, so ordered. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair requests that subsequent referral to judiciary be requested to be withdrawn and by the Speaker's office, and I request that we withdraw that.
Okay, the motion is to withdraw a request, have a letter of request to the Speaker's office that the judiciary referral be removed, and we're going to get staff. I'm wondering if that's part of the overall. Well, that's one piece of a three-part motion. Is that right, Paul?
The motion is first of all, we can do pass.
Okay. Okay. So it's a three-part motion.
So you want the other two parts then? I figured we'd do this one at a time.
Well, you can do them all at once. The first part would be a do pass, then remove the subsequent referral to judiciary because we've removed the judiciary portion, but replace
that goes back,
replace that goes back to House budget.
Sure. Okay. And then I also request that a new referral to the House budget and request that this referral go to the House budget with a due pass recommendation as well.
Okay. The motion is to pass this on a due pass basis, removing the subsequent referral to judiciary and to replace the referral to the House Budget Committee. To the motion. Representative Is there discussion on the motion? Okay. The clerk will call the roll. Yes, I'm sorry.
I just have to ask Chairman Butler, why I'm just lost why we're sending it to budget instead of judiciary.
It may have budgetary implications if they need money to study themselves.
Okay.
However, the indication is that they do not need the money to study it themselves.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, this wouldn't be considered a death tax, would it?
The clerk will call the roll. The motion is to move this due pass to ultimately the budget, replacing or removing the referral to judiciary.
I think it was appropriate, but I said that.
Representative Oakland.
Yes.
Representative Escobar.
Aye.
Representative Felicio.
Aye.
Representative Paul.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Bryant.
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hass.
No.
Butler.
Butler votes aye. The motion, having received the necessary aye votes, will passes, and we will go ahead and make the necessary request to remove the subsequent referral and pass this on with a due pass motion to the House Budget Committee. With that, colleagues, we will close the public hearing, the work session. I'm sorry. Pardon me? We'll close the work session on 9:44.
Mr. Chair, this would have been a good signy die.
Signy die. Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I haven't filled out that questionnaire thing.
Colleagues, thank you for the engaging discussion. Let me just say this with regard to Senate Bills 896. That was the water transit vehicles. We have not yet received the amendments on that particular bill that was brought before us yesterday, and we are still holding on Senate Bill 283 pending additional amendments. So with that, colleagues, we will not have work sessions at this particular time on Senate Bills 896A or 283. But we'll hold those over until our next meeting on Wednesday by reference from the chair. And with that, so also 480 will be held over as well by reference from the chair. With that, we will then proceed with a public hearing on Senate General Resolution 14. Is that where we're at?
Yes,
the chair yields the gavel to Representative Berger for public hearing on Senate General Resolution 14.
I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 14. Steve?
Madam Chair, members, Senate Joint Resolution 14 is an amendment to the state constitution. It would be submitted to for voter approval at the May 2006 primary election. If the voters approved it, it would eliminate the majority voter turnout requirement to pass a property tax measure for any election held after June 15, 2006. And it also would restrict property tax measures to the November general election in any even-numbered year and to the May election in any year. So there would be three election opportunities in a biennium to pass a property tax measure for the local option.
Thank you, Steve. Questions to staff? We have a number of folks signed up for testimony. I have a request. Is the superintendent of Gladstone Schools, Mr. Bob Stewart, here on a very short timeline? So why don't we ask him to come forward first? And Representative Barnhart, are you on a do somewhere else? And Representative Devlin, or Senator Devlin?
I'm due somewhere else, but I can be here.
Well, why don't you? I think.
The superintendent go first, and I'll go second.
I understand he's on a short timeline, but I know you folks are too, so I can't judge that. Why don't we, if you'll hold Mr. Stewart just for a moment, and let's have Senator Devlin and Representative Barnhart come up and.
Oh.
No, you don't want to. Okay. He's fine. I know he's on a short time. They are doing another
I can't get everybody all at once. And you're next. You're on deck.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I really appreciate the chair of the committee allowing this bill to have a hearing. I was here before on a similar bill some months ago, H.J.R. 14. For the record, I am Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. The intent of Senate Joint Resolution 19 is to replace the double majority, not to repeal it. That may seem a distinction without a difference, but it is not. In 1996, voters passed Measure 47. An obscure provision in 47 required property tax measures to meet two standards. First, the measure must pass by a majority of voters casting ballots. And second, at least 50% of eligible voters must cast a ballot. The general election was exempted from that requirement. Thus, the double majority requirement was added to the state's constitution. The justification in 1996 for a double majority was that measures were being intentionally referred to low turnout elections, where governments could simply rally their supporters to pass the measure. I do not actually deny that this did not occur. In fact, I can actually probably cite some instances in which it did. However, when we were faced with the problems of 47 in 1997, a measure that was clearly one of the poorest written initiatives that has ever made it to the ballot, we felt that we had to replace it. And to replace it and to get public acceptance of a replacement, we had to mimic it. So Measure 50 kept the double majority. But the legislature, which is little known, also simultaneously referred out an outright repeal to the May 1998 ballot. That repeal of the double majority failed by a 51-49% margin. But a lot has changed since 1998. Vote by mail has changed elections. Referral to obscure elections are no longer possible. We then, at that time, we had 8 elections per year. Now we have 4. All voters now receive a ballot in the mail, so there's no one that's really going to be surprised that an election is occurring. Turnout has improved dramatically under vote by mail. And since we passed Measure 50 and converted to a rate-based versus a tax-based and levy property tax system, the number of property tax measures making it to the ballot has decreased substantially. Why is this proposal before you, and why is it what I would consider a replacement and not a repeal? I will be honest. I believe a repeal that was simply a repeal would fail again with the voters. I believe that this replacement would not. This provides for 3 elections in a 2-year period. Property tax measures would be limited to the May election in the odd-numbered year and in the May election and general election in the even-numbered year. Why do I think we need to do this? The problems that were identified by the advocates for Measure 47 really no longer exist. But we've also had situations since that time when many measures that have had broad public support have failed because they've fallen a few votes below the 50% turnout. In some cases, they have failed even if all those people that hadn't voted had actually voted and come in and voted no. They've still failed because they were, you know, a couple hundred votes below the 50% turnout. Why am I personally opposed to the double majority? It has a lot more to do with some of the basic elements of our democracy. We live in a representative democracy that values voter participation. Self-determination is at the core of our Constitution and at the core of our values. For more than 200 years, Madam Chair and members of the committee, Americans have struggled and fought to protect our rights to self-determination. For many Americans, the right to vote came only in the last century. Women have had the right to vote for less than 100 years, since 1920. Persons of color were systematically prevented in this country from freely exercising their right to vote until the Voting Act right was passed in 1965. And as many of us know that come from that area, 18-year-olds did not have the right to vote, although they had the right to be drafted until 1971. Of all the reasons cited here today, again, my most fundamental reason is I believe this goes against the very grains of our constitutional democracy. I have no problem whatsoever with voters rejecting measures. That's their right. I'll defend their right to reject measures. But by I almost said. You should at least participate to make the decision. In closing, members, our right to vote in a free and equitable electoral process is at the core of our democracy. President Lincoln said it probably better than anybody will ever say it in his Gettysburg Address in November 1863. We here highly resolve that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that the government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth. The words that all of us most often remember from that phrase is of the people, by the people, and for the people. Clearly, Lincoln believed that our freedoms come with responsibility. If Abraham Lincoln were here today, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think he would tell you a double majority that rewards non-participation in our representative democracy has no place in our Constitution.
Thank you, Senator Devlin, for your words. Questions of the senator? You evoke Lincoln, it silences the room appropriately. Thank you very much. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I represent House District 11, Central Lane and Linn Counties. I have passed out three documents. One of them is a series of newspaper articles about the last election. One of them is the testimony of Representative Dave Hunt, who was unable to be here today. And the third are my comments. And I'm going to be brief because Senator Devlin has covered most of the points of concern. I want to reemphasize that in a double majority election, if you're opposed to the measure, it is an excellent strategy to simply not vote. You get to vote twice, in effect, that way. Because voting no, actually going to the polls and voting no adds to the number of votes cast, and therefore one more vote toward that magic number of 50% plus one to accomplish one of the majorities that is necessary in order to pass a property tax measure except on the general election ballot. And of course, so that casts one no vote, but simply not voting at all when your intention is to vote no, casts two no votes. The first no vote on the measure itself, and the second no vote to reduce the number of ballots that are cast in the election and thereby make it more difficult for the measure to achieve a majority of the number of voters in the district. So the results that the good senator describes are exactly right, and we actually allow those who are wanting to vote no and choose not to vote at all, the chance to vote twice, in effect. I will note that the superintendent from the Gladstone School District is here, and I'm not going to talk about the issue that he's going to raise, except simply to say that this is an example where if enough of those no voters had actually cast a ballot, the measure so that the measure got a half of the voters plus one, it would have passed because there were enough yes votes actually cast for that result to occur. There were a number of other measures on the ballot that failed because of the failure of the double majority, and we're talking about the most recent election in Jefferson County, almost 2-1 in favor of a new jail, but it failed for lack of the double majority. In Marion County, the Cascade School District failed a bond measure to build an elementary school because of the lack of a double majority. In Umatilla County, three fire districts passing levies by almost 2-1 still failed because of the failure to achieve a double majority in that May 17th election. Now, that election was not unique. In 936 property tax measures, 122 of them have failed because of a lack of meeting the double majority requirement. 80% of those measures had at least a 40% turnout. 61 of the measures that failed under the double majority rule would have passed if all the votes needed for a 50% turnout had cast a no vote beyond the numbers that actually did vote. So you can see that strategy works, and it works well, and it is, as the senator said, very anti-democratic. I will note that before double majority measures were passed, there were 8 elections every year when local governments could put measures before the voters. This proposal would make it 1 in 1 year and 2 in the other year, which is a reasonable reduction from 16 to 3, and I would urge the committee to consider and pass this joint resolution. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Are there questions of Representative? Yes, Representative Galizio.
Representative Barnhart, I had a question. I understand you have a law degree.
Yes, sir.
Okay. The proportionality question, equal protection under the law, I mean, has there been a court challenge to this? Because it seems to me that, okay, the non-lawyer.
No, there has not, but I have been visited recently by attorneys that are planning to file such a challenge.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Appreciate your remarks today.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Stewart, thank you for your indulgence. We welcome you here.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity. You've been presented with 6 letters, and
Mr. Stewart, would you give your name for
that? Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Bob Stewart. I'm superintendent of Gladstone School District. You've been presented with 6 letters from the community of Gladstone. We found out about the hearing at 10:30 this morning, and those letters all were developed during the day today by those individuals. Had there been more time, you would have had a lot more letters. There are people that are pretty excited about this in Gladstone. So that you know, Gladstone is a suburb of Portland. It sits between Oregon City and Milwaukee, it's a community of about 11,000 people. The size of the district is about 2.5 square miles. I believe it's the smallest geographically school district in the state of Oregon, not by students by a long ways, but geographically. This last fall, we had a 45-member task force come together to review our facilities. The conclusion of that task force was to present a $29.8 million bond levy to the community to relieve overcrowding, to develop new facilities for students, and to replace a section of a school, and replace heating and ventilation systems along with roofs that had long outlived their life. The committee very carefully considered when would be the opportunity to place that ballot on an election date. And there were 3 considerations in that. The first consideration was the extent of the issues that we were faced with as far as the facilities, how badly they needed to be repaired and how soon. The second consideration was when could we get the best value for the taxpayers. In 2004, construction costs in the Portland metropolitan area increased by 20%. We also were at a very low cycle for bond interest rates. And those 2 factors, as far as a value to the community, we were recognizing the longer we wait, the more construction costs were likely to increase, and the greater possibility that interest rates would be higher. The final consideration was knowing that we needed a 50% majority. We considered that the May 2005 election was possibly doable in Gladstone because of the size of our community and the ability to go door-to-door with a campaign that people could have in contact with our schools and with individuals. With that in mind, we held 5 community forums. I spoke at 12 different community meetings and service clubs. We sent out 5 mailings to the community. We went door-to-door on 2 occasions, knocking on every door in Gladstone. 3 times residents were called from phone banks. And on the final 2 days prior to the election, we picked up ballots. The results were that we had a 61.6% yes vote in the election. The downside is that Clackamas County had a voter turnout for that election of 21.9%. In Gladstone, our turnout was 43.2%, twice the county average, but below what we needed. We were 422 votes short of what we needed to have to pass the ballot. Had all 422 voted no, we still would have passed with a 53% yes vote. We had volunteers that reported numerous times, and I could name names, but I won't, of people that told volunteers that they would not vote in the election because they did not support the measure, and they felt the best chance for defeating the measure was to stay home and throw their ballot away. Basically, we found out that throwing the ballot away was more powerful than mailing the ballot in. What will happen to us in the interim is we'll patch things together the best we can for the next 2 years. We know the community as a whole will support the proposal that we've put in front of them. That proposal will likely be back in front of voters in November of 2006. The downside is that that proposal could cost taxpayers 15% to 20% more than it would have if it would have passed today. Or we do 15% to 20% less projects than what we proposed in this measure. I would encourage your support of this measure to send it on. If I had the ability to make one modification in it, I would suggest to you that there should be at least one election every year that would be available for not requiring the double majority. The reason is that it allows local jurisdictions to make investment decisions for their taxpayers that make the most sense for their taxpayers and their community, taking advantage of when construction might be at the least costly and taking advantage of when interest rates may be at the least costly. You asked the question about a court challenge. I have been contacted by an attorney. It may be the same one that's contacted Senator Devlin. I don't know. But I know that there is an interest in pursuing this on legal grounds, and I don't know if that will occur or not.
Mr. Stewart, thank you very much. Are there questions? Mr. Representative Gleeson?
So would it be fair to say that on SJ 14, you would just like in this body an up or down vote?
That's correct. I'd like an up or down vote to see the opportunity for this to move forward.
And would it be accurate to say that this body should refer this to the Oregonians so that they could decide whether or not they wanted to?
Absolutely. I'd forgotten the close vote that occurred to the correction of this measure, the 51-49 vote. But I think, without question, the number of people in Gladstone that have this became real. Before this election, it was not real. But it became real of what the double majority really means to people. And they knew what the impact of these facilities would have on students in our school district and on the investment they have in school facilities. And they've lost that opportunity now.
Further questions? Mr. Stewart, thank you very much for taking the time to come down and bringing the letters from your folks. At this time, I'd like to invite Mayor Tom Hughes from Hillsborough and Mr. Ken Strobeck. You might as well come up with him, and we'll hear from cities. And follow that with Marcia Kelly. Do you want to come up now and sit in the chair just for time's sake? I've kind of got the cities and... Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to come before you today. I could probably come with an equal number of horror stories to those that Mr. Stewart told, having taught in the Beaverton School District for 30 years and been mayor of Hillsborough now for 5. We have our own library story to tell. We have there was a Beaverton school levy a number of years ago that was defeated and had a sufficient number of voters turned out, it would have passed. I can remember as a teacher promoting school levies back in the days when we had to do pretty much annual school levies and bond levies. That the biggest problem we had to overcome was voter turnout. If we got a good voter turnout, then we won the election, because there was about 15,000 to 16,000 no voters that turned out at every election, no matter what election, how much you held it, where you held it. They always found us and they always voted. So you had to get a turnout of at least 30,000 plus voters in order to get enough yes voters to overcome that. So our experience in Beaverton was actually the reverse of the argument raised by the people who promoted this in the first place. I've been, as I do more frequently as I get older, I've been trying to go back through my memory, but my memory, failing as it is, seems to recall a measure that was on the ballot prior to Measure 47 that actually enacted the double majority, or would propose to enact the double majority as a standalone item, and that was fairly soundly defeated. And that may have been a dream that I had one afternoon while I was.
I don't know.
But that might be worth having staff look into it. So, I mean, I think that the track record on that as a standalone item goes both ways. I would talk about it not so much from the standpoint of the bad things that have happened to the libraries that are restricting hours of the schools that aren't built, of the number of cops that aren't on the street in Washington County because of the way this has. But in reality, those are our problems. I mean, those. That just you approach every election with the terms that the election has. I just think it's bad public policy, and it's bad public policy for about three reasons. I had and the biggest of those is who gets to vote in elections. I have two daughters. One lives in Seattle. One lives in Washington, D.C. 7 years after my oldest daughter graduated from the University of Oregon and moved to Seattle and had been registered to vote in two different places, she was still on the rolls in Washington County despite my best efforts to get her off and her best efforts to get her off. She had to actually come down one day and sign an affidavit saying she'd moved out of. And our other daughter had a similar experience even though she was in Washington, D.C. So the rolls are not purged, and it's not easy to purge the rolls of people who've actually moved out of town. And so though my two daughters wound up being no votes on every bond levy and special election levy that came up during that period of time. When we were working on the library levy a couple of years ago, we went through the voter lists for making phone calls and mailers. And as I went through them, I noticed a number of my friends who have unfortunately passed beyond this veil of tears and gone on to some greater reward someplace else. And I think in terms of what Senator Devlin was saying, that extending the vote or expanding the vote when we expanded it to people who were not white, and we expanded it to people who were not male, and then we went to people who were under the age of 21 into over the age of 18. But extending it to people who have already died, I think, is probably reaching a little bit too far. But in reality, until they get purged off the rolls, those people are all no votes. And I think that's bad public policy. And I would echo something that Mr. Stewart said in our experience phoning people for the library levy that we did last the cooperative library levy that ran on the May ballot, we had a number of people who said, yeah, I just throw my ballot away because that's a good way that everything goes down. I don't have to worry about whether I'm going to vote for this or vote for that. I just everything goes down. And again, I think it's bad public policy to reward a lack of thoughtful behavior on the part of the voters. So I would urge an up or down vote on this. Let the voters decide. Run it forward onto the election. Let those of us who support it do what we can do to get it passed. But give us a chance to get it on the ballot.
Thank you, Mayor Hughes. Questions, Mr. Master Representative Hess?
Well, I was just going to make a comment that on this issue of dead people voting. Maybe that's something that we should have that mortician's task force.
I knew you were going to bring that up. You were just that's waiting.
In this building,
the proximity was...
Or we can issue a death tax.
All right.
Yeah, the proximity was just too close.
I could hear that coming. Thank you, sir. Thank you for coming, Mayor.
Thank you.
Mr. Strobeck.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, Ken Strobeck with the League of Oregon Cities. Very interesting discussion here. I participated as a member of the House Revenue Committee in rewriting Measure 47 into Measure 50.
And you were chair for how many sessions?
Well, I was just chair for one full session and another interim. But nevertheless, the characterization that was made by Senator Devlin is exactly correct. We would not have put the double majority into any measure had it not already been in Measure 47, and the commitment at that time with the authors of that measure was we're going to try to replicate as much of Measure 47 as we could into Measure 50 to make it workable, and so that was one of the pieces that had to be included, even though that was not one of the central issues of the campaign about Measure 47. If you recall, it was sold as a cut and cap measure on your property taxes, and very little, if any, discussion occurred about the double majority provision. I also find it interesting that when that measure was referred separately in May of 1998 as a separate measure, Measure 53 at that time, the vote was upheld, as you've heard, by 51% to 49%. However, there were 623,410 votes cast on that, less than 50% of the statewide voters. So if that had been a measure that actually had to follow the rules for which you were voting on, it would have gone down because it didn't have a 50% majority. There's so many ironies involved in this bill, or in this provision. And, of course, the low turnout or so-called sneaky elections were one of the major reasons for advancing this provision to say, well, that way you can't just get your supporters out to vote. And that is gone now. We have vote by mail. Not only do we have vote by mail, we have on the outside of the envelope in red letters, contains proposed tax increase. So nobody has the excuse that they were uninformed that there was a tax election going on. It shows up in their mailbox, and it shows up in red letters. You've also heard the stories and the numbers, statistics cited about the history of the double majority. Just a copy of the report that I handed out to you was begun by the League of Oregon Cities in September of 2003 because we had heard these stories that there were cases where no votes or where non-voters had had more influence and so forth, but that was never documented until one of our staff people went around to all 36 counties, got the election records, and put the data together that you have in front of you and assembled it on a statewide basis. And so that we were able to document that of the 936 property tax measures that failed due to the double majority, or that were on the ballot, 122 failed because of the double majority, and of those 61 would have passed had all the votes necessary to get to 50% been cast as no. And another way to quantify that is a vote in May of 2000 involving Portland Community College lost when, even though yes votes exceeded no votes by 33,460, they only needed 2,207 more votes, either yes or no, in order to get to the 50% majority. So in this election, each of the 2,207 non-votes counted as 15 votes, when you put it in that kind of context. And as Representative Galizio observed, that is completely contrary to one of our fundamental democratic principles of one person, one vote. I won't go into more detail. There's plenty of material for you to read in that publication. And if you have any questions, we're certainly able to respond to them. I would just make one other observation that Mayor Hughes touched on briefly about the assumption that a double majority makes is that you have up-to-date, current, accurate voter records. And I don't believe we have anywhere close to that level of accuracy in our voting records now, particularly as you saw during the last general election when there was a huge effort made to sign up new voters to vote in the November election. And many of those people may not have permanent addresses, may not have any intent of ever voting again in an election, yet they're now on the rolls. They now have raised the bar so that the 50% threshold is even higher than it was before with all those new voters. So anyway, this is an idea that that should be reconsidered. It's a modification. As Senator Devlin said, it's not an outright repeal. And so I would urge you to take action on the bill, refer it to people. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Strobeck. Welcome back to the Revenue Committee.
Thank you so much.
Questions? Ms. Kelly.
Vice Chair Berger and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the legislative coordinator for the American Association of University Women of Oregon. We have over 2,000 members plus members at large in the state of Oregon, and our members include members of the legislature, people who sit on city councils, people who've been mayors of cities in the state. We've always been very active in public policy since our founding in 1881, or our predecessor organization's founding in 1881 on the East Coast. They started public policy by working for sewer systems in the cities to alleviate disease. Didn't have the right to vote yet, but they were working in public policy and, of course, worked to get the right to vote in the 20th century. This year, the Portland branch is celebrating its 100th year as a member of the American Association of university women. They were founded in 1905 and were the first branch in the state. We also have 28 branches around the state. Lakeview, Wallowa County, Astoria, Seaside, Lincoln City, Curry County. Women who participate in elections, work to get out the vote, work to educate voters, work with other organizations to do candidates' fairs or community forums when there are issues. And so we're very supportive of reducing or eliminating the double majority, or at least sending it to the ballot so that the citizens can work on that, for many of the same reasons that you've heard from other people. I have personally worked on many campaigns where people are not active on the roll. Hopefully, with the Help America's Vote Act and the centralized voting registration system, we might be able to clean some of that up. But that's a might, and it's going to take some while to do that. One thing that hasn't been touched on, and I know this because I am a small, minuscule elected official, is when you have to go to the ballot more than once to get something passed, it costs your special district or school district or city because you were assessed part of the election cost. I believe for the transit district in Salem, it's normally about $37,000 if we're on with two or three other people or if we're on a general election. And I'm looking at a potential of being on the ballot in 2006 with our transit district, and that's a concern that I would have, needing to get the double majority. That's just personal, but that's exemplary of our members because we have people, as I say, sitting on city councils. In fact, Gladstone, we have a member on that city council. I used to know it as Happy Rock because I grew up in Milwaukee. We always called it Happy Rock. The double majority needs to be changed, and it would be a great thing that we would help work on if we send it to the people. I think I've touched on absolutely everything. And, yeah.
Anything further?
Nope.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Questions? Thank you to this panel. Appreciate your spending your Friday afternoon with us.
Thank you.
Julie Sohanek and David Williams are the only two left. You've been patiently here all day. Anyone else wants to sign up, spend their Friday afternoon with us, just rush up here. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Julie Sohanek. I'm with the Oregon Community College Association. We represent Oregon's 17 community colleges and over 330,000 Oregonians. We echo the comments of the supporters of the legislation, both about the value of equal representation in terms of the vote, and even more so about the fiscal impact that this has had for our colleges. We know that the League of Oregon Cities did speak to the Portland Community College issue. We've had Rogue Community College also pass a bond with a majority, but then be denied because of the double majority law. This comes at a cost to our colleges who already do have scarce resources. We are often asked when we meet with you what we can do to be more efficient and find ways to be more prudent users of taxpayer dollars. This is one of those solutions, and we encourage you to move this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sohanek. Any questions? Please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association, and also speaking on behalf of Chuck Bennett for the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, who could not be here. We support the measure wholeheartedly, support it in the Senate, hope that it will come up for a full vote in the committee in the future at some point. It's not a tax measure, it's a voters' rights bill, and we couldn't support it more. Our members consistently have supported reforming the double majority requirement. I was going to have for you today, but my computer system was down. On the OSBA website, we have a very nice elections analyzer, which you can use to sort election results since 1997. And one of the tabs on there, you can sort it to show all elections that have passed by a majority vote but lost due to the double majority requirements. Very interesting to go through and review the districts and the sizes of those districts and the sizes of those bond measures that have failed. But I think one point made earlier, just to reiterate, for a lot of our school districts, districts, and especially the smaller districts who have great facility needs in the state, that a large cost to them is re-upping their local option or bond measure in a second election when it goes down in a May to double majority. It is obviously, if you pass by majority, they're very interested in putting it back on the ballot, and very often do in the November general election, and for the most part, those, I did this at one point, very, very few of those failed that second time on a majority vote in the November general election. But as mentioned before, this is a substantial cost to districts as they share in the cost of those elections. So another sort of feather in the cap of reasons to move this on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Are there questions? Well, thank you very much. I think that it's appropriate to note for the record that we are in public hearing only, and we have not posted for a work session on this bill, which is somewhat unfortunate. So I will close this public hearing. Paul, when is our next scheduled meeting?
Next schedule will be by the time officially scheduled, but Wednesday.
Okay, so Monday we are not scheduled to meet. Okay. So let me adjourn today's meeting of the House Revenue Committee.